You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and you can get all the information about my forthcoming stand-up comedy tour from ComediansComedian.com. I'm coming to a town near you, provided you live sort of south of Manchester and within 80 miles of a major city. I hope I'm coming somewhere near you. All of the details, ComediansComedian.com, and click on the link to find my tour dates and schedule. And you can follow at ComComPod, or indeed at Stu Goldsmith on Twitter, where I will be trying to keep you abreast of all the interviews and bits of press I'm doing along the way in an attempt to make this my debut tour the resounding success that I've always believed it might be. Thank you so much for your support about this already. If you fancy bringing someone along, remember that I'm going to do a little off-the-record ComComPod Q&A at the end of each show for as long as we can until I get kicked out of the venue. So all details at ComediansComedian.com. This is Nathan Caton, an absolutely wonderful comedian, and as you're about to hear, an incredibly warm, generous, nice, well-balanced person. Let's see if Goldsmith can get stuck in. Where are you in your career at the moment? For people that don't know you, there's a lot of people listening sort of outside of the UK. Yeah. What kind of level are you at? Did we start around the same time?
Yeah, I think we did. Like late 04, early 05?
Early 05, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's when, just before my 20th, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. Because I think of us as being like the same year at school. Do you
yes,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we haven't gigged together much.
No, we're both in demand.
Hey, there we go, there exactly, we go.
That's what it is.
Very positive. We'll be coming back to that positivity later. But so where are you? Where do you see yourself in the league tables of British comedy?
Okay, if it was like a football analogy, I'd be like maybe an Everton, like on the cusp of maybe breaking into something big, but not quite there yet.
Okay,
there's a bit more work to be done.
Okay, I mean, I don't know anything about football. Okay. I don't know why I said league table. Well, I thought I've already automatically put myself in dodgy territory. Well, here.
That's when you messed up. No, I think I'm in all the clubs and stuff. Like, you know, I work the circuit like a crazy man. I've done a bit of TV, and I reckon I'm maybe on the cusp, maybe
like any minute now.
Or I'm looking for something to kind of like break me. If that
yes,
makes sense.
Okay. You know, okay.
Like I've done Live at the Apollo. I've done, I think, 4 Mot of the Weeks now. Mm-hmm. Done my Sours Good News. So people kind of know who I am. Mm-hmm. Or like okay, in the comedy world, people will know Nathan Caton. Yeah, he's a comedian on the circuit, whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, say, like, if you ask just an everyday person who Nathan Caton is, they wouldn't know. Or they might see my face and go, well, I think I might have seen someone before.
Yeah,
that
okay.
kind of thing.
Okay.
So yeah, it's like I can kind of see the promised land,
yeah.
but there's a sea in the way, which I've got to swim over.
Okay. So you, like me, I guess, have seen lots of people start at the same time as us and after us,
yeah.
who have just blazed away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, Sarah Millican.
Yeah, of course. I remember doing I Did So You Think You're Funny with Sarah Millican and Kevin Bridges.
Okay. Oh, wow, bloody
yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, those are my two go-tos. Yeah, and I mean, also loads of other really great comics who've kind of hit different levels of success yeah. Well, since then.
I did Amuse Moose. I was runner-up to Sarah Millican.
Were you really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not bitter. Damn her! No, actually, that's cool. I'm sure she's great. I'm sure it's success. And also Laughing Horse. Remember that competition?
Yes, yeah. I do. I Carl Donnelly won the one I was in.
Oh, so that was the year after?
That was the year after, yeah.
Yeah. 2006, was it?
Yeah, probably was.
2000,
yeah.
I did 2005. James Branch? Do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember James. Yeah.
He was a really good writer.
He was a fantastic writer. I wonder if James is still secretly writing for Hills. Other people. With... I don't know. Who
Hills Jagos.
He was it. So, my God, James was a great, great actor. Yeah. I'm sure still is if he turns his hand to it again. Mm. I think James did an editing, I think he edited movies or movie trailers or something. Like he had a really good job in the meantime, but I couldn't believe he was the one who, did he win? Did he?
Yeah, he won. Wilkinson was second.
Okay, gotcha, gotcha.
So yeah, see that. So I'm looking out on Joe Wilkinson, I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
Back in the days doing Laughing Horse Wimbledon, the watershed.
So are you, and you say that with real, like, you've got a real smile on your face when you say that. Like,
yeah.
Like you're not someone who... Like, you're absolutely working the clubs, a completely safe pair of hands as an actor. Do you know what I mean? You're like, you're a closer, you're a, you know, you can do that, you can do the job. You haven't yet, just like you said, you can see the promised land. Mm. But I think a lot of people in our kind of position or that sort of that duration, are sort of have had moments of going, oh man, is this ever gonna happen?
That's what's natural, isn't it? Like, it's just human instinct. You think, oh, I'm doing it for ages now, like a decade. Like, surely, when's the door going to open for me? But at the same time, it's like, well, I've been doing it long enough now to know it's a long grind. You know, it's not going to come easy. You got to work for it. So, and also, like you said, like, talking about, like, Sarah Millican and Joe Wilkinson, I'm happy to see, like, people from, like, it's like, been in the same school as you were saying.
Yeah.
You see people from your class doing well. It's like, yeah, go on, man. You do that.
Yeah, thing,
yeah, like,
right.
It's like a family kind of, so to speak. You see someone of your same kind doing well. It's like, that's good, man.
But not everyone feels like that. And I think the fact that you see it as a family, and we'll come back to family, is really representative of something about your comedy, which I've been watching a bit. I listened to a bit of your series.
Yeah, yeah.
And go on. You sound like you know what I'm going to say. What do you think I'm going to say?
But the whole family orientation and kind of like being embedded in that, having that culture in me. Is that what you're going to say?
It wasn't actually. That's in there. Oh, that's okay. In there. We'll talk about the radio show as well. But it seems to me that there is something really, having watched a lot of your stuff recently, I've seen you in clubs and stuff, but I've kind of been researching you as a prep for this.
Cool.
And it seems to me there's something really warm-hearted about the stand-up that you do. There's something really kind about it. There's something really positive about it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, well, I kind of, that's just me as a person, I like to think. I think I'm a good guy. I'm not, I've tried doing like, you know, like a bit edgy or roughier material, but every time I do it, people go, nah, come on, Nathan. I remember a few years ago, my old agent, I did a joke and it was very blue. About, you know, what you do to a woman and all that kind of stuff in the bedroom. And I remember doing it, and afterwards my agent was like, you're too nice for that.
Yeah, like, right.
You can't pull it off.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's not you. Just stick to doing, you know, topical stuff or jokes about your family, nice, warm stuff. And yeah, I think that's just me. I'm a bit of a softy, a bit of a teddy bear.
Yeah, you've got a bit about intervening with some lads who are nicking a car or trying to break into a car.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where you talk about, like, yeah, you know, because I can be a bad boy. And literally in the setup for the bit, the audience are laughing at the idea of me being a bad boy.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're going, no, come on, Nathan. No, come on, mate. We haven't known you that long, but we know enough to know. You are soft as.
Is that, and that, I mean, I've just been listening, the episode I was listening to this morning of Can't Tell Nathan Kate Nothing, which is now in its third series. Has it just done three series?
That was, yeah, Thursday was last year.
Last year, okay. Yeah. So there's an episode where it's like a, you know, it's like, he's soft as and then it always gets cut off. Oh, you know, the idea of you being soft is sort of prevalent in that episode. And do you mind that? Or, like, do you want to be an edgier comic? When you were trying this other bluer stuff, why were you trying that stuff? Were you trying to break out of a thing, or were you...
I think I was just experimenting, really. Kind of just trying to find my voice, so to speak. I don't know. It's just every now and again, you just kind of have an urge to kind of just play about with stuff. You know, mm-hmm. I like to kind of experiment with my act and see what I can do. I'm now comfortable with who I am.
Yeah, okay.
I don't, like, if I'm in a fight, I don't mind backing out. Come on, let's hug it out, man. Come on. Kumbaya. I know who I am now. I'm a big teddy bear who's, yeah. I'm a nice guy. I don't want to, you know, be offensive and edgy and stuff. I just kind of like to just be myself and who I am. It's kind of a big softy, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I do material about maybe something edgy, but it will come from a warm kind of angle, so to speak, you know.
Yes.
Like at the moment, I've got material like on like whole terrorism stuff just something going on, but it comes from a different, warmer perspective.
Okay.
A harsher, blunter edge.
Yeah, I've noticed there's a bit of yours about Mandela's death. There's a bit you did on Apollo.
Yeah.
And one of the premises of the bit, you're talking about wider points about black heroes in the UK, like black icons, hero figures, cultural icons. And you're also talking about the experience of racism of like a black footballer having a banana thrown at him.
Oh, yeah.
And the angle, the line that you take is that that's really antiquated racism.
Yeah.
And that's like a really nice way to approach that topic and talk about it without being kind of, because I suppose when you're someone who deals, as you do, with kind of topical stuff, but not necessarily hard political stuff.
Yeah.
You're able to find like a warm and personable way of dealing with a difficult issue.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want to do. I want to talk about stuff, but I don't want to offend people or like put people off. I want it to be like I want to be charming at the same time as talking about real stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go right back to the beginning. How did comedy come across you?
Stand-up wise or comedy in general?
Comedy in general or whichever came first.
I knew about comedy from probably about seven, eight, like a young kid. It's because my family used to watch Lenny Henry a lot.
Or
Ainsley Harriet.
Unbelievable. Oh, my God.
My family used to watch Lenny Henry a lot because, it's kind of corny to say now, but it was because, you know, because he's black.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a black comedian before Lenny who was on TV a lot in Britain.
Sure.
So when he came out and he was talking about, you know, the whole family stuff and his family come from the West Indies, like straight away, like my family were like, okay, we get that. We can relate to that. So we kind of, Lenny Henry was on a lot in our household.
I was a massive fan. I've just remembered all the Delbert Wilkins show stuff that he used to do. Do you remember the Delbert Wilkins and Spondicious and all the rest of it?
Spondicious
was Delbert Wilkins' catchphrase. It was like invented patois. He'd be like, Spondicious, guy. Yeah.
I remember there was the old guy in the hospital.
Deacus, maybe?
What was that his name?
He was like an old Jamaican guy. He's like, my name is...
Yeah, and he used to have alcohol in his IV bag or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I think it was a different character.
There was a guy in a shop, the news agents. There was the priest, the Reverend priest.
Yes.
Tried to be cool. Yeah. My family told me that when I was a kid, I used to kind of copy and imitate it. I don't remember doing it, but they told me that.
Okay.
And then I kind of like watch other comedians, like Eddie Murphy, even though I shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
I watched like Delirious and stuff. So then by the time I got to about 16, I knew of comedy and it was something that kind of appealed to me. Because I was that kind of imitate the comedians that I saw and copy their acts and stuff. Actually, my first stand-up was when I was 14.
Really?
Yeah. It was a talent show at my church. I got dared to do like a five-minute spot. And I went on stage and I just did jokes about the people in the church. And then I did a spoof of a Lord's Prayer. Incorporating again the characters from the church and stuff. I stormed it.
That sounds amazing. I was like, this story is going to go one of two ways.
I'm now banned from the church. Yeah. I'm an atheist now. It went well, man. Yeah, I remember like sitting down, and people were like, "Oh, well done, Nathan." I was like, oh, "I want to do this, man."
Yeah, right. Who dared you to do it? It was like a friend or like
a friend.
And why do you think they dared you to do it?
Because I was always joking about and mucking about after church with my friends and stuff.
Okay.
And there's a talent show coming up, which we had every year, and she was like, instead of joking about all the time, go on the stage and do some stand up. And I was like, all right, cool, I'll do it. Cocky teenager.
And that is a pretty confident approach to do crowd work. Like, I mean, had you written stuff about notable people in the church, or were you just riffing?
I'd written some stuff.
You'd written some stuff?
Yeah.
So that's ballsy, right? Like, I thought you were going to say, so I went on and did some Richard Pryor stuff.
Yeah.
That's what kids normally do.
Yeah.
You know, if it's like, I remember some, like a friend of mine had a brother who, their rugby team's Christmas do, some of the rugby team just lifted a load of We Are Clang sketches. Do you know what I mean? Like, and this is like maybe 8 years ago, something like that. And they're adults, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it was
yeah.
a 14-year-old to go, I'm gonna write some stuff.
Yeah, actually, I didn't think of that.
Yeah, man, that's pretty studious. That's pretty...
It was just like teenage, like... just no inhibitions, no fears, like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know, when you're a teenager, you're cocky, innit? He's like, yeah, I could do anything.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and that's what I just did. Like, I just went and I made some jokes. I ran the jokes by the same person who dared me.
Okay.
And she was cracking up, so I thought, all right, cool, it must work. And then when I actually did it worked.
That's great.
Yeah, it's great. I felt like Jesus.
Yeah.
Looking across going, say something, what?
You're not allowed back in church.
Exactly.
So after that, was that kind of like, this could be a job?
Yeah.
You went, hang on a minute, I've really got something here.
I didn't know if I had it, but I thought it was definitely something that I wanted to do.
Like the horizon is there. You're like,
yes.
Oh, this is a possibility.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a little light came on. But I didn't say anything. I didn't really say much because I knew my family would kind of not be against it, but they were like, you need an education.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pick up a book, study that instead.
Yeah.
So I kind of kept it quiet for a good, maybe until I was about 17, 18. Just put my head down, went back to being a good boy, did my GCSEs, went to college. And the plan was architecture.
You worked. Did you work as an architect?
No,
did
I studied.
You trained? You trained. Okay.
I did a degree, architectural technology. Yeah, and that was always the plan. I was like, I'll do that, and maybe I might do comedy as a hobby.
Okay,
maybe but the plan was, yeah, just do architecture because I was too scared to confront my family and say, no, I'm going to be a comedian.
So this is Nathan. It's probably becoming clear that although Goldsmith can get stuck in, there is just more layers of nice under the nice. What a good dude. Oh, this stuff about his mum and his kind of emotional place and kind of registering his place in the comedy. I rejected two words there mentally, firmament and pantheon, both of which have overtly religious things. I'm rereading Mike Carey's Lucifer graphic novels at the moment, so I'm thinking in terms of pantheons and firmaments. But nonetheless, what I'm trying to say that is in the world of comedy, Nathan is just... such a positive part. And as we talk about, he doesn't sort of really involve himself all that much with the comedy world. You don't often see him out on the town in Edinburgh. He's just quietly, diligently putting the hours in, putting the hard yards in, and getting better and better and better. So please seek him out. If you haven't already seen his live stuff, seen him on YouTube or indeed on Mock the Week, do try and catch him on tour. That conveniently leads me to segue onto my own tour, of course. Please do come and see Stuart Goldsmith an hour in a variety of places, which I shall rattle off to you very quickly now. Birmingham, Nottingham, Kingston, Windsor, Crawley, Manchester, Bristol, Southend, Canterbury, Aldershot, Hemel Hempstead, Milton Keynes, Bath, Norwich, Leicester, Northampton, Wolverhampton, Soho Theatre in London, Sutton, and finally the secret Welsh festival that we don't like to talk about. Now, I've been getting weekly sales reports on these shows. Some of them, I'm so excited to report, have sold as much as 35%. And that doesn't sound much, but if it's a 100 capacity room, that's 35 of you. You're the people buying tickets to this. You're the people who want to come and see me and support me, and I really appreciate it. Not every single venue is doing quite as healthily as that. And I'm confident as well, because it's still a month away, that we're going to sell out at least a few of them. Bristol's looking good. Southend's looking fabulous. Manchester, I've got a lot of confidence in. Excess Malarkey, brilliant club. And if you are in London, please do come along to the Soho Theatre. This show is an absolute belter, and I would like to lean on your... What will I lean on? Not your charity. Don't do me any favours. It's just a great show. So if you want to come along and see it, all the details are at comedianscomedian.com, and it is packed with all your favourite Jack Reacher, Wagamama, Costa Coffee, Dementia, Map My Run material. And it's not about anything. Or is it? No, it isn't. More waffle after the podcast. I'm kind of quite getting into the spirit of doing increasingly long rambling sections after the podcast. Thank you to all of you for putting up with those. I've had some very nice comments about them on email, info@comedianscomedian.com, and indeed on Twitter @comcompod. But I'm very lucky to not have had any negative comments on them, which I assume is because if you've got a minute into them and thought, well, this is balls, then it's not material or anything, it's just me talking. So that presumably those people who've got a minute in and thought, oh, this is not for me, can just tune out. And you've already got this sweet-ass free content from comedianscomedian.com. If you'd like to support the show, please continue doing so. I don't want to hammer you with too many messages at once. We've got a few T-shirts left if you'd like the famous ComCom Pod T-shirt. And remember, if you're one of the people who's bought one of them, you can tweet me a picture of you wearing it in the place where you listen. So we've had dog walkers and runners. I really hope that guy... Do you remember that guy who was a dentist who said that the podcast had helped him a couple of years ago? I think he was Australian. He said that the podcast had... helped him kind of hone his ability to give lectures to dental students. I want to see that guy with a ComCom Pod T-shirt on a photo of him in a dental lecture hall, if such a thing exists. You know what I mean? I'm going, hey, track down Nathan, track down my tour. You can still be a member of the Cavalry if you want to put up posters in your place of work if you're in one of the towns I'm coming to. Thank you so much to those of you who've done that. And, of course, you can support the show financially if you so desire, if your heart desires. I'm still in a very Lucifer graphic novel oriented. Whatsoever your heart desires, follow me down to the briar. I've got no idea. There will be. I'll explain for those of you who are unfamiliar with the show. I now have a 2-week-old baby. He is a little miracle. And the me time, the dad time that I'm getting to enjoy is precisely 20 minutes of reading a comic book on the toilet per day. I will tell you more about that in the ramble at the end of the show. But let's get back to Nathan. Is there anything else? I always ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I tell you these various things. And then I always thank you to my pod gremlins, Ryan and Livy and Ben and Emily and... Other Ben, 2 different Bens. They wouldn't have known. I could have just said one Ben. Thanks for your help with logging this show and the ones like it. We've got loads coming up. I believe next week is going to be Hari Kondabolu, so there's plenty of time to watch a load of his stuff on YouTube and indeed download Hari's special, Waiting for 2042, 48, not sure. Search Hari Kondabolu, you'll find it. It is just the quintessential, fiery, young, vigorous, political, very, very funny album. And as you'll hear in our conversation, we talk in detail about the recording of that album and the response, which if you listen to it, you're going to hear a lot of people whooping and cheering as well as laughing. And we get into the mechanics of whether Hari's happy with that and exactly what the circumstances were of that recording. So do your homework, download the album first, and you'll get much more out of that podcast. That will do me for now. Let's get back to Nathan. What a lovely sausage. Nathan Kay.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Was it real pressure or was it perceived pressure on your part? You were like, I'm too, like, you're nervous about saying, look, I want to be a comedian. Yeah. You didn't actually have a moment of saying, I might I might jack in the architecture college and
yeah, I didn't. It wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't like that. It was just, I think it was just more what I thought the expectation of me was.
Yes.
So yeah, it was more perceived, and I just thought the good thing for me to do would be to just get an education, because that's what my family have always drummed into my head from like a young age.
Nathan, you are such a good boy. you are such a good man.
Just grow a pair of testicles, Nathan. because the thing is, like when I was growing up, most of the time it was always pick up a book. You know,
yeah.
I'm bored, pick up a book. Yeah. You know, I'm hungry, pick up a book. Any little thing. And so, yeah, I kind of thought, you know, education is vital and I don't want to let them down. So, yeah, I went to college, uni, and then it was at university when I kind of thought, I want to do something now. I didn't quit the degree, though. I finished it. But after my first year of studying during the summer holidays, I thought, might as well just give it a go now.
Okay. And where did you choose to give it a go? What was the first...
I don't know what the name of the comedy night was. I know the venue was called Bar 187 in Old Street.
I'm trying to think of it. I can't picture it.
I don't think it lasted more than 5 gigs.
Okay.
It was really bad.
That's so funny. That's just made me think those early days of when you're booking gigs. You don't realise that gigs spring up and exist and then die.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, have you done so-and-so? And then like 2 months later, people are like, never heard of it. What are you talking about? And you're like, oh, I'm in there with Bar 187.
Yeah, exactly. I've got 5 minutes, man. Yeah, it's weird because I was in Time Out. Remember when you had to buy Time Out magazine?
Yes. Buy Time Out magazine and there were phone numbers.
Yeah. I was talking to this to another comedian the other day, a newer comedian, and they were talking about like, that they go on Facebook and stuff like, on the forums and they get gigs.
Yeah.
I was like, man, you guys are so spoiled.
Yeah.
you had to spend money on the Time Out.
Yeah, yeah. And then you had to ring a human and convince the human that you had material. And they can hear in your voice. Yeah. You had to ring Pete Graham at the King's Head and go, I've definitely got 5. And he'd go, do you? And go, no, I haven't, sorry.
That happened with me and Julia Chamberlain.
Yeah, okay.
This is when I first started. She's like, are you good? I was like, yeah, man, I'm great. And then I did a gig and she just didn't say anything to me afterwards. Like, you're not that great, are you?
Oh, man.
It's cool. That was years ago. Now she's cool. She books me. It's fine. I've rebuilt that bridge. But yeah, that gig, 187. Bought Time Out, called him up, said, yeah, come down. It's a guy called Wayne something. Not Wayne at the Comedy Cafe, different Wayne. Okay. He's a big guy. Yeah, went to this gig and there was only about, there was maybe 8 acts and maybe about 6-7 punters. Which at the time I was like, I don't care, it's stage time. And it was in a little bar, there's a stage in the middle and then there were people playing pool behind the stage and then they drew a curtain to kind of like section it off. And then I just went on stage enthusiastic, man, because... Like, yeah, I didn't care about there being more acts than punters. You know, like, weird, like, the more you do comedy, like, the more kind of, not peeved off, but the more, like, enthusiastic, in a way, you kind of get, like, if I were to do a gig now, and there were 8 acts, if there were more acts than punters, I'd be like, I don't want to do this gig. Like,
yeah.
There's got to be a ratio of at least 10 punters to 1 comedian, otherwise I don't want to do the gig.
I've never heard it expressed as a ratio before, but that's perfectly reasonable.
But yeah, you know what I mean, though. Like, it's like, yeah. If there's...
Like, if it's a one-man show, if it's a preview and it's just you and there's 10 people, that's a gig. Yeah. It's got to be a 10-to-1
yeah, exactly,
ratio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If there's 5 acts and 49 people, I'm not going on stage. I went on stage and did some awful material. The premise, it was about... I was 19, so it was about young guys trying to pull girls in a club. And I don't remember the whole routine. I just remember one line where there's a girl at the front and I went, hey, baby, do you like chocolate? Do you want to try some? And that was the punchline. It was so shit. But I should point out, for the podcast, I'm black. I can say that. Yeah. I don't walk around with confectionery. Hey, baby, you want a Kit Kat? Let me get your number.
Yeah, that would have been a joke.
Yeah.
Do you like chocolate? Do you want to try some? There's a Kit Kat. What were you thinking?
See, yeah. If only I had that kind of writing skills when I was 19. I was just as cocky as, you know, it's awful. But as bad as it was, I liked to be on the stage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, even though I died, I felt...
You, it was a death, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was awful. It was bad. Like, if I was there, seeing my 19-year-old self, I would have like booed and said, bruv, come
never
off stage,
this,
man.
Never do this
again. Yeah, just come off, man. Sit down. Yeah, pick up a book. Listen to your yeah, but it was a death. It was awful. But I liked the fact that I was on stage. I felt good about being on stage. I don't know, it's maybe just a bug of like feeling comfortable on the stage in front of people. I just needed the material to go with that confidence.
Did you feel confident and happy off stage as well? You know, a lot of comics kind of get into it and actually they're trying to fill some sort of a void. Do you know what I mean? I don't say voids too much.
Yeah, I know what you mean though.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Was I confident on the stage? I kind of. I reckon. Was it? It's hard to say. All right. I think maybe I was trying to do comedy, but off stage, I used comedy to fill not an emotional void, but to cover up emotions. That's the word.
Which emotions?
Hurt. All right. The reason why, because when I was 12, this is what I did in my last Edinburgh show. No, yeah, last year, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. My mum went through a really bad breakup with my younger brother's dad. So it would have been my stepdad. And it was like, proper, like awful. Like my mum was like in the worst I've ever seen in my life. And I kind of used comedy to make her laugh, to kind of cheer her up. And I reckon that was kind of something that kind of just stayed with me. Even now, to this day. Because my girlfriend still says, you know, why are you always making jokes for? And I guess it's just kind of like a reflex tool. But I think, okay, that's too emotional. Joke.
Yeah.
So I reckon
that's too emotional for them. Like, they're feeling sad, so I'll do a joke. Or it's too emotional for you to have to let in the emotional bit. So you do a joke. Who does the reflex save? Does it save them or does it save you?
I reckon it saves me. Yeah, anything too emotional, I'm like, oh, I can't deal with that. And I think off stage, that's how it was. Like, I hid my emotions underneath the humour. The humour just covered everything up.
Do you still do that now?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I didn't realise I'd do it, but my girlfriend tells me that I do it all the time.
So she gets frustrated because she can't talk about real stuff with you? Like, what kind of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what kind of situations, what kind of emotions are you trying to avoid? Are you trying to avoid anger? Are you trying to avoid sadness?
Probably sad. No, not anger. It takes a lot to really get me angry. I think just more sadness. Because of everything that's happened in my life, I just think I don't want to tap into that kind of area, that sadness again. So
over your mum's breakup?
I think that's when it started, when I was about 11, 12. So
it wasn't just a case of her being sad, but presumably the knock-on effect from that was that you felt sad.
Well, I felt sad because I saw my mum in pain.
Yeah.
And that just tripped me out.
And if you make her laugh, then she feels better, so you feel better.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So it's like a smokescreen. So
that
even...
Thank you. That's, man, in something like 150 episodes, no one has said... No one's kind of described it in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really honest. Have you... We know you make a lot of jokes about your family. Have you... You said you covered this... Or some of this in Teenage Mutant Nathan Cato,
yeah,
which is one of the most painful puns I think I've ever heard. I loved it.
But I love the Turtles.
Big Turtles fan as well, man. Which turtle were you most like? Which was your favourite?
I would have said Raphael because I want to be a bad boy.
Yeah.
But I'm soft as. So truth is, I'm Donatello.
Same,
man.
Same.
Yeah. That geeky, kind of good boy kind of, yeah.
I wouldn't have said like Michelangelo is the one everyone likes because he's like
the funny one. Yeah, yeah.
And I just was like, come on, you're pathetic. You know, I was better at emotionally analysing the reality of the turtle's life. Like, okay, Michelangelo, he's giving it all this. Actually, I'm more like Donatello, whilst behaving like Michelangelo. sorry, for the benefit of the listener, you could look all this up online.
Yeah,
this is going to mean very little.
Research turtles, man. Oh, man.
So you covered this in the show. How close did you get? How much? Because I didn't see that show. But how much did you dig into it? How much... For you, how much of your comedy is, there's an emotional thing, that's a starting point, here are some jokes, and how much of it is, let's really get into the meat of this?
Before 2014's Edinburgh, not a lot, like barely. Like, I didn't show any of that emotion. But in 2014, I dug deep into it. So much so that I cried at my first preview of it. I burst into tears because it hit me. I was like, I did not see that coming. And I can explain. Because the show was about 2014, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, about me not being able to walk my mum down the aisle. She got married. And I didn't give her away. And it really annoyed me that she didn't choose me. She chose her half-brother from Canada. And I was like, well, why wouldn't you choose me? I'm the prominent man in your life. I've been here for 30 years. Like, you know, my grandma didn't want to do it. My little brother didn't want to do it. So I thought, I'm her eldest. I'm the obvious one. And it was proper, like, it was like a stab in the back from, I felt, on my mum's behalf, like, are you stabbing back? Why wouldn't you choose me, mum? So I kind of talked about why I was so hurt by it, and it was because of everything that happened with my mum when she broke up. I kind of felt a duty to go, I need to just protect her, so to speak. Because when she broke up, it was just her, me, and my little brother. So I was like, I felt like, okay, I'm the man here. I'm going to protect you guys.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I was talking about that in my first preview, yeah, it all came out, and I started crying.
How did that feel to be crying on stage? Did
Weird.
You kept going? That was like at the end of the show, during the show?
Yes, in the last 5 minutes.
Okay.
Last 5 minutes, and then I do a routine which kind of brings the laughter back. But yeah, the first time I did a preview, like I thought, yeah, I could say this on stage, it'd be fine. But then when I was actually on stage, that first preview, and I said it, it just all came out, man. It was weird. The audience, they were, blessed them, they were loving, they were cool. And afterwards, like, the comedy was like, Fries, it's quite amazing to see that kind of emotion. Yeah, that's real. But for me, I got back in the car and I was like, what the hell just happened there, man? Because it just wasn't expected. And then I did another preview. I mean, I didn't cry after that, afterwards, because I think once I just let it out, because I'd never said it out loud before. So it's like, maybe it's like all those years just been bottled up inside. Saying it out loud, it just, boom, everything just came out, all the tears came out. And after that, I was fine. But I did previews afterwards, when after, like, the compares would come up to me and go, mate, that was deep. That's probably the first time I tapped into, like, the whole emotional stuff of the show. And doing it in Edinburgh, I think people either loved it or hated it, in that they'll like that I was so real and so emotional. But then some of the reviews, they were like, it got too serious. Like, not that check reviews, but just seeing what they were saying. Like, it got too serious. So it was like, people either tapped into it and understood that I was being real, or people like, that's too much for a comedy show. That's just, considering that you've been funny for like the previous 50 minutes, all of a sudden you've just gone, whoa, we weren't ready for that.
Did you tour that show?
No.
So you're on tour at the minute?
No. My next tour is until next autumn.
Okay. So would that be your first one? Tour-wise, sorry. If Teenage Mutant Nathan Caton, sorry, yeah. I can't say, it's a bit of a mouthful. If Teenage Mutant Nathan Caton was your show from 2014,
yeah,
and it didn't tour, so did you tour this year's show already?
No.
But you're planning to?
Well, I'm planning to write a new hour, whether bits of this show
okay,
or last year's show gets into it.
Okay. So did your mum see the Ninja Turtle show?
No.
Did she know about it?
She found out afterwards. I didn't say anything before because I don't think I could have handled it. I kind of just kept it to myself. The only person that I told was my girlfriend.
Okay.
And even then, I told her very little. Like, I was like, just wait until you see the show and you'll get... Because obviously... I remember, I think we were having a conversation about why I always make jokes and stuff, like, you've never been emotional, you know, some girlfriends can be. And I was like, wait until Edinburgh, see the show, and you'll have more answers. You'll see why I am, why I like to joke about rather than being emotional. And she saw it, she was like, I get it.
So would you like your mum to see that show if you could get over it, if you'd recorded it?
No, I haven't recorded it.
No, I mean, if you had, hypothetically, had. would you like sit her down with it and leave the house?
Yeah, I could. I know where I could watch it with her because I might just break down.
Oh, man. So have you spoken to her now that she knows what the content of the show? I mean, that's almost worse if she knows that it was about her but hasn't seen the stuff.
She knows roughly that obviously the show is about me being angry or upset, but she doesn't know about how emotional it gets. She doesn't know. If she saw that, she would probably break down in tears. Then I'll probably break down in tears from seeing her cry.
Would that be good, ultimately, that after you'd both cried, you'd go, okay, I'll get it now?
Maybe it might be, just need to just let it all out, both of us. But I don't know, I guess I'm maybe a bit too scared to take that risk.
Yeah, because it's really interesting hearing you say that about a 12-year-old boy feeling like you've got to be the man of the house. Yeah. I'm sure that's happened to a lot of different families, a lot of different situations. I wonder how much of that is still with you now, that you feel like on some level you still are her main protector. She's remarried?
Yeah. But I still feel, like I'm...
You're the one that's definitely going to be there still. Like, you can't divorce your mum.
Yeah, well, do you know what I mean? I'm still living in a house. I'm not planning...
yeah, of course you are.
I'm not planning to move with house prices at the moment.
I can't believe... I mean, that is... I read your blog about the house prices.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We'll come on to that. But that is particularly intriguing, I think, that you wrote a really meaningful story about your mum and your relationship with her, and she hasn't seen it, and you live with her.
Yeah, well...
So you weren't pacing around your bedroom saying the script out loud in case she could hear it.
No, exactly, yeah. Yeah. Note to self, Nathan, record this. No. I hit it well I hit it well because most of the time I'd be like joking about with my mum. That's the one when I'm at home, which isn't a lot because I'm always gigging, but when I'm with my mum, I start to kind of just joke about her and take the mic.
Yeah.
And that's my way of being close with her rather than the whole emotional stuff.
Okay. So this year's the most recent show, Straight Out of Middlesex.
Yep, that's me.
did you take lessons from the tapping into the emotional stuff into the next show? How did it change? I mean, you didn't, that's fine too. I'm not saying it's a show you're working out, Nathan. But like, did it change the way you wrote, having had that experience and gone, I've gone somewhere different?
It kind of put me off being emotional again. Because it got such a divided, I think, opinion, the emotional stuff, I thought I'd go back to what I know. So I just, this year's show was just an hour of just stuff, topical stuff, some family stories, and it was more of a feel good thing, more of a just kind of an hour of ha 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 ha, rather than a story with an emotional thing at the end. It was more this, I don't think I can handle emotion 2 years in a row.
Yeah, this next show's about my little brother. Oh god, what am I gonna do?
Yeah. I love him, he's like my best friend.
Yeah,
this year's show was just back to basics.
So you see your role as a comic is purely to make them laugh. It doesn't matter if you...
I like to make people laugh, obviously, but also kind of make them think a little bit. So if I'm doing jokes I mean about something current or topical, it's my opinion on it, and I want people to laugh, but I also want people to go, oh yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah.
And do you think comedy can change people's minds? Can it just raise the subject?
Yes, I think so.
But, okay, it can raise the subject. Can it change people's minds? Can you...
Possibly. I mean, yeah, I think if it's been talked about enough and you deliver like a pinpoint, like, you know, set on it or delivery, then I think, it does have the potential to change people's minds. Whether it will, obviously, yes. Don't know, but I think comedy is a powerful tool. Laughter is a powerful tool because everyone laughs, so I think it can be done.
That's really interesting, man. I'm really interested about the stuff about your mum, the personal nature of it, and the fact. Just saying, your mum then reminded me of how much material you've got about your mum. How funny is that? You should have called the show your mum.
I did. I want to call my show. When is it? It was either between Your Mum or Teenage Mutant Nathan Caton.
No, what informed the decision? Why did you decide this?
Because my agent was saying Your Mum is too aggressive.
Oh, I think that's a real shame.
Yeah, I would have loved it. Shame. Like, I reckon I could have seen myself doing a tour called Nathan Caton, Your Mum.
Yeah, that's funny. Loved it. That's yeah. funny, right? Is this your previous agent, the agent that made yeah. that decision?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can we talk about that, or yeah. would you rather not?
Oh, if you want, I don't mind.
You were one of the people who got shed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You were with a particular agent, yeah. and they changed their business model.
Yes.
And dumped a lot of really good acts. Mm. How did that feel?
Weird, because nothing was said. There was no explanation for it. Like, if the agent had come out and said, listen, I'm starting up my own production company, so I just want to focus on that. Then I would be like, okay, fine, I understand that. You want to go in a different direction, that's cool. But because there was nothing, no word, just axed, it was like, what's going on? She goes crazy.
Was it like an email?
I got an email. Because I was emailing the person who was looking after me, my agent at that whole company. I was emailing her because I was getting, ironic enough, there's one time where I got a bit frustrated because I was doing my Radio 4 stuff, but then nothing else. Like, there was, when I joined them, they was like, oh yeah, we can get you this, doing that, on the whole TV stuff, all that. And there was nothing. So I emailed them saying, what's going on? I'm now getting a bit frustrated. Like, finally, my breaking point. I was like, what's going on? Like, the only work that I'm getting is the stuff that I'm doing myself. I had the Radio 4 when I joined you guys. What are you guys bringing to the table? And then she emailed back saying, yeah, we understand your frustration. We think it's best if you find alternative representation. Just like that. Wow. And I remember it was my brother's 18th birthday and I was sitting there going, yeah, I've just been dropped.
Wow. And what a way to do it as well. That does suggest, like, I feel like if that had happened to me, I'd have been like, oh, well, if you felt like that, why didn't you tell me that a year ago and yeah. let me get, you know, whatever my last year's worth of work out? I've had a similar but different sort of an experience where I think from the point of view, it was fun. We don't talk about representation much on this show for obvious reasons, I suppose. But I think something I have heard various agents say. Either when they've been looking after me or when I've just been chatting. You know, once you've been in the business for a while, you sort of know various people that previously you wouldn't have spoken to. And you're like, oh, that guy's my mate now. Yeah, you know, it's quite fun. But I feel like there is an understanding, almost like a misconception amongst agents. Because they have several, I mean, it's the old thing actors used to say, you know, they've got loads of clients, you've only got one career. Do you know what I mean? So you've got to be someone who's sort of looking out for you. Mm. But I think agents, because they deal with lots of clients over a broad, you know, amount of time, like maybe when a new comic encounters an agent, the agent's been an agent for 20 years, they know how it works.
Yeah.
I think sometimes they assume that comics know how it works.
Yeah.
I don't know how you felt, but I've always felt like, oh God, I mean, if I do this, am I supposed to ring? Should I say anything? Should I not say anything?
Yeah.
Repercussions? Yeah, and then definitely. You do something like that and go, hey, I'm very slightly frustrated. Yeah. Well, then you dropped.
Yeah,
what?
Exactly. Yeah, it was like a bolt from the blue. It's like, oh, right, gosh, jeez. It was weird. But given that I'd heard stories about other acts being dropped leading up to this, sure. when it happened, I was like, okay. So I wasn't as angry as maybe I would have been, or hurt as I would have been.
And I suppose from your own sort of description of it, if nothing was happening anyway.
Exactly.
You know, all the stuff you've got yourself, you've got it, you know.
I'll just carry on doing the gigs that I've been booking myself. Thank you very much, that kind of stuff.
And you're a big, like you've mentioned a couple of times already, just sort of conversationally, gigging all the time.
Mm.
Like, how many nights a week do you try and gig?
At the moment, maybe I'm six, maybe seven.
Yeah.
So I'm all the time. In fact, I was putting a list yesterday, top 20 hardest working comedians in the UK.
On what list? What was this on?
Ents 24 or something.
Okay,
like that.
Okay. Oh, they're the people that you can put someone's name in and they'll tell you whenever
yeah, exactly.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Apparently, I don't
know. I think that's why I thought you were on tour, because I was Googling you and one of the sites that came up was Ents 24/7 and it said
cool.
Nathan Caton so-and-so, Nathan Caton somewhere else. So I was like, oh, that's a tour.
No.
And actually, that's just
gigging.
A hard-working man's diary.
Yeah, a person who hasn't got a life, basically. Yeah.
So tell me about that. I've certainly been through phases of just working as much as is humanly possible, to a Monahan extent. Which has advantages, which has drawbacks as well. Have you always been someone like that? You just like fill the diary, fill it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've always, well, just in life, like before I started doing comedy, I've always been a hardworking person. Again, that
yeah, it's basically doing architecture college is sort of cheating as training for college. I always think whenever I get this with Oxbridge people as well, whenever anyone's been to Oxford or Cambridge or been a doctor, I'm like, this is completely unfair because you have such an accelerated work ethic compared to everyone else. You, can we tie some lead weights to you or something?
I like to think I've always been hardworking, and that stems from my family because they work amazingly hard. So just seeing that, it kind of just felt like the norm. That's what you do. You got to work hard to get where you want to be in life. So doing comedy, yeah, just the diary, just fill it like. Cause, and also, it helps that I enjoy what I do. You know, I love it. Like, I like writing new material and going on stage and trying out and seeing if it works and stuff. So yeah, that helps me work harder. So yeah, that's just something that it's part and parcel of the game. You have to work hard if you want to get anywhere in it.
Do you have a similarly methodical approach to writing? Are you a get up in the morning, put the hours in? What does it look like? What does your writing process look like?
It's changed over the years. Like before, I would kind of wake up and I'd make an effort to just sit down in front of a laptop or a notepad and actually write stuff. And I would write the joke out word for word. Yeah, I did that for a few years. But then I kind of noticed that I'd write the joke out, learn it like it was a script, go on stage, and obviously when you're on stage, it's totally different. It's a different animal. Like, things happen. Like, people might say something. Your flow is different. And then I say it, come back and listen to it, and I realize that I've said it in a completely different way, which is funny and still works, to how I wrote out the joke. So I've stopped doing that. Instead, I'll just make bullet points of things that I know I want to talk about, and how it comes on stage is however it comes on stage, and I listen back to it and I'm like, okay, that's how it is.
So you make the bullet points of the things you want to talk about, and you trust yourself now to just go on it like a new material night,
yeah,
and just talk about the stuff,
yeah,
and see if any of it's funny.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Rather than writing out like a script, I don't want to be rigid in that script. Have a bit of flexibility. Say what you want. In terms of writing, like, I try and write every day, or write at least one new bit every day. Even if I don't sit in front of a laptop or a newspaper, I'll be sitting like maybe having some food or something, and I'll be on my phone because you can do anything on your phone now, isn't it? Go on BBC News, whatever. See some topics, and then I'm like, okay, I can talk about that. What could I talk about that? You know, like at the moment, like, obvious one is like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Because that's just a comedy gift, isn't it? okay, what can I talk about Donald Trump? And then I'll just, in my head, instead of writing it down, I'll make mental notes. Okay, that. Okay, what can I say about that? What can I say about that? So kind of, instead of writing it down, I'll just maybe just sit there, right, and I'm, in my head, I'm writing.
Okay.
And then I'll do it at a gig. And then once I've got it, then I'll write it down. So it's, yes, kind of, it's like I've reversed from how I first started.
Yeah,
when I first started, I'd write it all down. Whereas now, I kind of do it in my head, blurt it out, and then come back and write it.
Okay. And have you ever written with anyone else? Have you written for other comics or with other comics?
I've written for some comics for... what's the Channel 4 show? Stand Up for the Week.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I wrote for that a few years ago. I haven't written with anyone for my own stand-up. Because I don't know, not being snobbish, but I kind of like to, I think stand-up's got to come from you, innit? It's you're the only one that's on stage. You know? It's how you feel. And so I kind of think, that's not that I don't want to work with other people, but it's just my thing.
Is that the same when you've done Mock the Week as well? Because as I understand it, with Mock the Week, you get like a massive dossier of all the stuff.
I ain't gonna lie, I have used that as a...
cheated
on that
one. I'm not trying to catch you out.
But... Damn you, Godfrey. No, but the stand-up bit in Mock the Week, that's my stuff.
Of course, okay.
But then like, the other, like, the scenes we'd like to see, I've used that for that stuff.
Okay. How does that feel if you're so used to doing the stuff purely from your own voice? Did it feel like you're wearing someone else's clothes? Or was it not a problem at all?
I don't mind, like, using other people's jokes for that, for the scene stuff. I reckon it's more of how the process of it, like, do you meet up and write? Do you just do email and stuff? Because I'm so not used to that. I'm just used to the kind of just doing my own thing, just sitting down and writing in my own time or writing how I want. So I think it's just, I think more the process is where it's like, do we meet up? You know, that feels more like tricky to me than actually just saying the jokes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So when you're looking at a subject like Donald Trump or a story about your family or something, you get the starting point. Mm. And are there particular things that you do? Are there things that you kind of catch yourself doing each time to pull the funny out of a subject? Have you got like kind of principles or rules or just a certain angle of attack?
Have I got certain angles? I try and do something that's obviously funny, fresh, coming from a weird angle that no one else is coming at or people won't come at. And like if I'm doing something about my family, like I might have like the end punchline that I know I want to get to, but it's just how I get there that I need to work out.
Okay.
And then if I'm doing something like topical stuff, I might have a point that I want to make, but again, it's how I get there.
Okay. Can you give me an example from a recent bit?
Okay, what have I got about Donald Trump? Oh, okay. Yeah. I talk about how I want Donald Trump to win because I want us British people to look at our politicians and go, could be worse.
Yeah, okay.
So, yes. So I'm explaining, I've got to justify why I want him to win.
Yes.
And it's about how I get to that point.
Okay.
So that people go, oh, okay, I get what he means now. It's not because he supports him. It's because that kind of thing.
And are there things that you catch yourself doing and think, I did that last time? Do you know what I mean? Do you recognise kind of habits?
Jokes.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean the exact wording of the joke, but like, you know, joke formats almost.
I actually did that on one Donald Trump bit. He was talking about how some parts of London aren't safe to go.
Mm.
And then I wrote a joke and I was like, wait a minute, that's the same kind of joke as I've used for another bit, just a different word, just different place.
Right, okay. What was the shape of it? What was the shape of that particular joke?
It was talking about how some places are a dump and how you can't go there. But I just changed the place. So it was. So instead of using London, I said maybe I would have said Birmingham or Manchester or something like that.
Okay.
So it's like it's a template. It was the same template, just different.
Yeah. So how did you react to that? Did you go, I can't use it again? Or did you go, I've changed it enough?
I tweaked it. I recycled it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because that other joke I hadn't used in years.
Okay.
So I just recycled it and just added more freshness to it, so to speak. So I kind of justified to myself that it was enough, that it's a new joke.
When you say you added more freshness, what, more detail do you mean?
More detail, more punchlines. Because the old joke only had one punchline, we just had a punchline and then something else, like a backup one. And just kind of made it more modern.
There seems to me in your stuff that I've seen on Live at the Apollo, the stuff I've seen when you gig, a trait of yours is a real kind of simplicity.
Okay.
Does that mean anything to you? I don't mean it as a criticism, but I think your stuff is like, it's really kind of open. Okay. Like you're not, and again, this is going to sound like criticism, I don't mean it to be.
No, that's fine.
You're not trying to be too clever. Like something that I end up doing a lot. I tie myself in knots because I'm trying to do something that's never been thought of like that. Every time I write a joke, I need to remind myself that I am not trying to write a Christopher Nolan film. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, oh, I want the end to be buried in the beginning and halfway through the joke, I want everyone to realise a clue that I left them earlier on.
The matrix of comedy.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know why I'm obsessed with this. I think I'm... Well, I would hazard a guess after a lot of these types of conversations, it's probably something to do with... Really, I want to point out to the other kids at school that I'm just as clever as they are. Do you know what I mean? I think that's where that comes from. But you don't seem to be hindered by any kind of bullshit like that. Do you know what I mean? You seem like you're a good man and you're a hardworking guy with a good work ethic, and you write jokes and you deliver the jokes, and that's it.
Yeah, no, yeah, just no thrills.
No thrills.
No, I just try and be funny, man. Whether it's clever or not, if it's funny and it makes me laugh, then I'll go for it.
So, who are your favourite comics on the circuit right now? Like non-famous ones. Who do you really enjoy watching? Who do you always come out of the dressing room to watch?
John Maloney.
Yeah.
Who else do I come out and watch?
What is it about? Let's get specific about John Maloney. What is it that you? Why do you think that you want to watch him every time?
It's just his style. So deadpan, boom, joke. I don't know. It's just great jokes and just his style. It's just there's a joke, boom. Take it, do what you want. Here's another one. Boom. That's it. And he's just great. Solid. Andy Askins.
Oh, man. I gigged with Andy Askins at Bestival recently, and he just destroyed. To a room full of, gurning 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
He just destroyed.
Again, he's quite mellow and deadpan as well.
Yeah. I mean, he's also got one of the best opening lines in the business. My name's Andy Askins. I've got absolutely no charisma. I mean, that is genuinely one of the single best opening lines there has ever been. That's up there with Incognito's "I'm not the best comic you're ever going to see, but I am the best in my price range." Do you know what I mean? It's like the jokes like that to me they demonstrate such an exquisite understanding of the thing that we're all in.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? I don't even know I can describe it better than that. It's almost like some understanding of the human condition.
It's just keeping it real.
Yeah, keeping it real.
Keeping it real. Andy Askins, again, because I love his style. And it's jokes just keep on coming. And there's no extra, it's not like a performance, dancing around and stuff. It's like, man, for Mike, jokes, boom, 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 boom.
And what skills do you see in other comedians that you're jealous of? What things do you see when you go, I wish I could do that? You know what I mean? Like, you're aware of your skill set.
Yeah.
So what do you think is missing from it that you would love to be able to put in it?
Ooh, quite a lot of things, actually. Off-the-cuff stuff, just riffing.
You don't, you don't riff. Do you riff at all?
I've started doing it more, last Edinburgh show. Well, last Edinburgh show, I don't live off reviews, but I check reviews after Edinburgh.
Sure.
And they were saying,
this is a safe place. You can admit here. You can admit that you've read the reviews.
Damn, Scotsman! The reviews. One thing they said, the one negative thing they said was that I riffed too much at the top. I spent too long chatting to the audience and having some banter and stuff.
Yeah.
That kind of cutting to my material time.
Okay.
Which had a point, because I did run out of time a lot.
Really?
I was kept on, I don't know, I guess I just got into it. Because obviously there's always the characters in the audience stuff. So I spent so much time talking to them that I was like, oh yeah, I've got a show to do.
Yeah.
So I only did maybe 40 minutes.
I think that specific bit of criticism belies the fact that comedy journalists or comedy reviewers or critics, whatever you want to call them, regularly see 10 shows a day or 8 shows a day, they want you to get on with the stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas comedy punters maybe see 2 shows a day and they're really happy to be entertained by a funny person that's improvising.
Yeah,
but you always, that's one of the things you're like, okay, that's some level 7 learning. Just turn up and do the stuff, because the people who are going to make big pronouncements about it, they just want
to
see the stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Just get to the jokes, man. Don't waste my time. Riffing, I guess that's something that I'd like to do more. I look to improve in I look to improve in all aspects of comedy, because like you never finish learning, do you? You're always like continually evolving and developing and stuff. But what else? When I see someone like Ian Stone, for example, like his turnover of material and topical stuff as well, I think wow, like. I don't think I turn over as much material as that, and I would love to be able to just you give him a subject, anything in the news, and he'll have something on it.
Yeah.
Like I do cutting edge sometimes, and just the turnover of material that those guys have got. It's like cool. Like,
do you know, I've never even seen, I've never even been to the cutting edge because I don't do topical.
Mm.
So I think for me, the writing process is so painful. I'm like, why go through all of that to come up with something that's only going to work for a week? You know, I think that's my fear about it. And I think I did see it once. I think I saw Alan Cochrane do it. He was kind of someone I knew before I was a comic.
Oh.
He was the comic that I knew. So I think I saw it once, but it's like, for me, it's like watching an improv show where you just go, this is not my skill set. Do you know what I mean? This is like, I can watch this. It's wizardry.
But it helps you, that, because I thought like that before I first did Cutting Edge. When they first offered it to me, I was like, I can't improv and do topical stuff that quick, but kind of it makes, you know, you've got it coming up, it makes you write stuff and it makes you do it. You're kind of forced into it. Like there's one game in a show where you walk to the stage and the audience shout out something from the news. It's happened in the last year or so. And soon they shout out and boom, you have to do a joke about it or routine about it. And that, it's petrifying, but it makes you do it. You know, you kind of think like, okay, I haven't got anything about that, but what have I got that can relate to it and I can get to it? That kind of stuff. It's scary, but it does work.
So when you're doing Mock the Week,
when
you've done Mock the Week, how have you found that? What's your experience been of that show?
Nowhere near as bad as I anticipated.
Okay. What were you expecting?
I was expecting a bear pit where I'd get bullied and then I'd go back into my changing room and cry in a fetal position. They didn't like me. I barely spoke. I remember the first time I did it. I got the news that I was going to be on it in Edinburgh. So I was talking to as many comics who had done it as I could. I was like, how is it? What is it like? And they were like, it's fine. Just talk, you know, it's not as bad. And then I remember when I got on set and they were saying, because particular comedians aren't there anymore, it's easier now to get a word in. And it was like, and also it helps that a lot of the comedians who I was on with that first time, I'd gigged with on the circuit. I had Mickey Flanagan, and like he was headlining the store and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into the bigger clubs, he was headlining just before he kind of broke
through absolutely.
The door. So it's like I had a bit of a
pre-explosion Mickey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I knew him before, so it was cool. And even before we went on to set, he was like, come into my changing room. Like, you know, he's like, come into my changing room. I'll give you that talk about how it's going to go. It was lovely. It was like, again, it's like family kind of thing, like a big brother looking after you.
Yeah, right.
Andy Parsons, who I gigged with a few times. So that was cool. Who was outside? Stuart Francis, again, who I gigged with.
Chris Addison.
Chris Addison, actually, I never met him before, but he was lovely. He was friendly. And then Hugh Dennis, who I've done a lot of Now Show on Radio 4.
Okay.
So again, it helped that I knew a lot of these people. So they were all cool. And then Dial was like, he was lovely. He was like, listen, is it any point you want to get a word in, but you can't, just give me a look and I'll stop the traffic for you.
Oh man, what a legend. I love Dara.
Yeah. He's quality. Absolute quality, man. That's what happened, man. So it was great. And then since then, I wouldn't say, not that it's got easier, but it's friendlier.
Yeah.
Like the last time I did it, it was myself, Hugh, Ed Byrne, Ed Gamble, Sarah Pascoe, and Andy Parsons.
Yeah.
And because obviously like, I've spent so much time on the circuit, gigging with like Ed Gamble and Sarah Pascoe and stuff, it was like just chatting with your mates. So it's not the bear pit that I expected before I booked for it.
So tell me about your radio series. Is there going to be more of them?
No. Well, the dream, touch wood, pray to God, is to transfer over to TV, which I've written a TV script for it and I'm working on it and showing it to people. I have to see now if anything catches the light.
Okay. Okay. What was it like to write? Did you write it? No, you wrote it with James Kettle.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, myself and James. It was a great experience. I'm grateful that I've had, because that before, like, I got offered that Radio 4, so I had no idea and nothing about. I knew nothing about Radio 4. I remember being in a car with Michael Fabry, and he was talking about Radio 4, and this was like years ago. That was about 2021. I was like, Radio 4, what's that? He's like, they do comedy. He's like, I had no idea. So now that I've done it, I was like, I see how massive Radio 4 is. I was like, how did I not know this stuff?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's brilliant, man, like, to write for that. Because when I first started, I wouldn't have considered myself a Radio 4 person. You know, I wouldn't have thought my comedy appeals to Radio 4 and stuff. You don't hear young black guys on Radio 4. But now that I've done it, it's been eye-opening, and it's broadened me.
Broadened in terms of your audience?
My audience and my writing. Like, I don't just write thinking like a young person. I think more mature now.
Okay.
Audience, definitely. Like, cause before I did Radio 4, I had a very young audience. And then I did my Radio 4 series. I remember I was doing the stand-up for my second series. And in front row, there were some students. And the next to them were an old couple who were in the 70s. And I was like, oh, this is lovely, man. This
yeah,
is cool.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because the format of that show is that you do stand-up and then it's linked by recorded live, the sketches?
No,
sketches are separate. So you do all of the stand-up for the whole series?
Yeah, the stand-up narrates all of the narrative that goes on.
Okay. And so one thing that really struck me from the episodes I've heard is how well it was plotted. Because I always think when stand-ups go, oh yeah, I've got a sitcom, I always think, how do you know the first thing about writing a sitcom? Do you know what I mean? Because I'm used to writing stand-up and you get the stuff and you talk about your feelings and you know what I mean? And you go down that whole rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And really listening to yours, I was like, oh, that's clever. That was mentioned earlier and that's come back in and it's all sort of woven neatly together. Did that come from you? Is that something you learned on the job? Or did that come from James? What was the...
I think James at first kind of like, he plotted it out. And then something that I kind of learned writing with him. So, yeah, he kind of... Because he's very good at, like, making me accessible to Radio 4. Like, okay. I'll write something and he'll be like, okay, say it in this way, because that will work, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, how do I say Wagwan on Radio 4, James? Yeah. And then he'll be like, okay, it's like this. he's good at plotting things out. And then, something that I picked up, I was like, oh, that's how you do it. So we kind of did it all together. And it's kind of like writing an Edinburgh show, you know? You've got the start, in the middle, the end. You know where you want to get, how do you get there, that kind of stuff.
I never have the start, the middle, or the end. And when I do, I don't know how I want to get
there. No one's got into, like, July 31st.
was there anything frustrating about the process?
Was
there stuff that you wanted to do that you didn't get on there or you were told wouldn't work?
Yeah. There was, well... No, it wouldn't work, but it's Radio 4, so there's stuff that, you know, you obviously can and can't say. That's the frustrating thing, is that, you know, it's like you have to kind of like dilute it a little, not dilute, but just kind of soften it a little bit. So it kind of takes a bit of that, ironically, a bit of harshness, or a bit of reality away. The good definitely outweighs the negatives, so that's all cool. But yeah, there are sometimes when like you want to do a certain scene and you can't do it and stuff because you know that, you know, people aren't going to like it or producer won't like it. Do your mum stuff.
Yeah.
There was a few more your mum's, like I do routine about obviously your mum jokes and stuff. And the producer was like, no, that won't go down well on Radio 4. Now you have to cut it out and trim it down. And I was like, but that's just me. I've got a gold mine on your mum jokes, man.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, c'est la vie.
And you, from what we know about Nathan Caton, I guess your attitude was c'est la vie rather than I'm putting my foot down. Yeah. There's going to be no series.
What? I can't have it. You know what? Your mum produces.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got to wrap up fairly soon. There's a couple of little kind of standard ComCom questions I'd like to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
What we talked about that review of yours that said not that you read reviews, but we talked about that your frustration at them kind of pointing out always too much stuff at too much chat.
Too much emotion. Okay, cool.
Oh yeah, too much chat. What would you? How would you review yourself? Like, if you were to be really honest, if you were a comedy critic, knowing as much as you do about your act,
yeah,
what would be your brutally honest review?
At the moment, right now. Can be a bit too rigid sometimes. Kind of sticks to the script sometimes rather than just kind of thinking, who cares, just do it. Because sometimes when I do think, who cares, man, just do whatever, I've been going long enough now to handle it. So if or something just happened, I can go with it. I can roll with the punches. But sometimes I'll take the safe option.
That's interesting. Pushing yourself out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
When you do it, God, it's great, right?
Mm, exactly.
And then sometimes it isn't. So you go, I'm not going to do that again. Especially if you're a hardworking guy, you want your money, you don't want to live with your mums forever. Do you?
Well, no.
I was going to ask, this is a slight tangent.
Mm.
You talk a lot on stage about the fact you live with your mums, which I assume is true.
Yeah, live with mums too.
I had assumed, having read your blog about house prices and stuff, all available at nathancaton.com,
yep,
I think.
That's me.
I'd assumed that was a financial decision. Are you actually protecting her by still living there?
It definitely helps that I'm still here, so I can definitely protect her. Maybe a part of me is, because a part of me does think, I have thought that if I do move out, is she going to be all right? How's she going to cope? Obviously, she's got my stepdad there and my little brother, but my little brother's only 20. He's at uni. He's only working part-time, whereas I'm in a position where I'm able to kind of provide and protect. So there's a part of me, even though a lot of it is finance as well, because I don't want to pay rip-off prices in London, but at the same time, it's like, well, what's going to happen to my family? I guess that's one of the reasons why I also haven't moved out of London, because there's a part of me, last year or so, I was toying with the idea of moving out of London completely.
Where would you go?
Maybe somewhere just outside of London, which is close to getting, Oxford, Milton Keynes, Reading, that kind of, somewhere like that. But then I was like, I'm very close to my family. So I don't know if I really, the idea, I can go. But in reality, could I really do it? I don't know.
I mean, you're gigging every night. You could move out and rent on the same street.
I don't know, man. But also, a lot of it is also finance as well. I feel bad paying $400,000 for a little tiny flat.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know. We'll see, man. But for the meantime, I'm with my mum.
That's beautiful. I think that's sort of a really lovely place to end it. I don't want to sort of make that extra meaningful. But I'm just sort of interested by that. You're good. You're a good man, Nathan. There'd be a lot of mums listening to this. I don't know if there'll be any mums listening to this. Normally mums are very young children or babies. And then we go, I'm going to call my son Nathan.
Yeah, and then a lot of producers are going, he's not getting a TV show.
Yeah.
Gosh, he's a grow-up.
Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah. Nathan last question then. What would you have on your comedy gravestone? You can interpret that question any way you like.
Oh, on my comedy
gravestone. Your final message to comedy.
He was a nice guy, wasn't he? That was it. That's it. He was a nice guy, wasn't he? He was all right. Yeah. Mr. Nice Guy.
Mr. Nice Guy. I like it.
So that was Nathan. Thank you so much to him for coming onto the show. Thanks to you for downloading it, sharing it with your friends, leaving me fabulous 5-star reviews on iTunes, and clicking on the individual episodes. You know now, whenever I post on Twitter that the latest episode has come out, I link to a specific page on the blog of the website so that you can share that page with pals. And get them to enjoy the show as well. I've had some lovely emails recently, but I've been chewing through them in my little late night. So last night, tell you what, I'll wrap up the podcast now. That was the podcast. Thanks for listening. And we should probably insert some sort of special sting. Did I think about this last time? Did I say it to you, or did I just think about it? There should be some, like, waves on a shore or something, just to, if you're just listening to this and sleeping. No, good. I don't want you to crash or run off the road. We'll come up with some sort of a different sting. Perhaps we've already done that by the time you hear this. Who knows? This is the waffle bit. Thanks for listening to the show. This concludes the podcast. Right. So, oh my God, I'm two weeks into fatherhood. What can I say? People say it's over. I've just lain down. You could probably hear the change in my voice. The thing that parents, new parents, all say to each other, and that existing parents say to new parents, it can be a bit overwhelming, can't it? That word comes up over and over again. Oh, it can be a bit overwhelming. What they mean is, you want to jump off a building. It's unbelievable. You've just, I'm so in love with this little Boutros. And that's not his name. I want to protect his privacy. I'm not going to put pictures of him on any social media. My partner is, but she's much more stringent than I am in her acceptance of friend requests. And I'm not going to say his name, but we've been calling him Boutros, or the Boutros, for the term of the pregnancy. And so I still, I forget to actually call him his real name. I call him Boo or Boutros or Boots, none of which are his real name. So for you, for us, for the podcast, for the listenership, he's called Boutros. So I'm just in love with him. Someone told me before we had him, they said, oh, when you have a baby, it's like your heart climbs out of your body and crawls along the room and sits there and looks back at you. And that is a vivid and disturbing metaphor, but it's not wrong. I'm so in love with him. But listen, I say that because I, being me, feel that when I got a set up, hey, guys, I definitely love him. It's all definitely great. Jesus Christ, talk about a game changer. I see now why all of you lovely, lot of dads, I've had emails from a lot of dads who've said things like, just relax, we can wait. Someone said today, a lovely guy called Jeff, I've been emailing with, he said, just take your foot off the gas. We can wait for another episode. Just enjoy this time. I really appreciate the emails that you guys and a few ladies have been sending as well. I think what's happened is that men want to send other men. Dads want to send new or prospective dads an email that basically says, oh boy, you've got no idea. And then you become a dad and they send you an email that says, see? It's unbelievable. It's like suddenly the perspective, already I'm a parent. Already, it's terrifying how fast I've become a parent. I've literally got sick on my cords. How much of a dad sentence is that? And of course, all the way, I've got this little thing bubbling away in the back of my head going, you can't just write a show about being a dad. I don't want to see the dad show. So I've got to notice things that aren't to do with this little guy. But there is something, so I'll let off steam here, if you'll forgive me. There is something about the way, the speed, the terrifying velocity with which I have become, oh, I'm a dad now, and any guy, any man that hasn't had kids, I completely look down on you. You've got no idea. I mean, I'm so pleased for you with your problems and your lack of sleep and your partying and your gallivanting. And I'm sure it's tough. Sometimes you must have to get up and you must be really tired. You've got no fucking idea. You've got no idea. And this is me 2 weeks in. So admittedly, I'm doing this stuff going, well, we've got no routine. They'll become a routine, but then the routine will constantly be broken. And I was emailing Jimmy McGee. Love, fantastic Jimmy McGee. He's yet to come on the show. He's too scared. But he's a dear friend of mine and an excellent comic. But Jimmy, he will be the first to admit that he gallivants. And I now instantly feel so superior to him simply because he's got no idea. I think it must be like suddenly becoming a woman or suddenly becoming an ethnic minority whereby you would suddenly look at the rest of the world, the ethnic majority, if that sort of awful phrase exists, or men, and you just suddenly you see it from this completely different perspective of going, oh, you're, yeah, well, absolutely, your problems must be huge. You must have real problems. My heart bleeds. Because you don't fucking know, man. So that's, am I talking about feminism through the lens of fatherhood? I don't know if I am. Maybe I'm not. Sort of the beginnings of an idea. And funnily enough, I thought that last night. This is, I don't want this ramble to be entirely specious. This section, let alone this one. But let's talk about protest. I was thinking that would be quite a fun way to talk about fatherhood whilst not talking about fatherhood. And this obviously will be in the tailwind of Bridget Christie and the brilliant way that she... The example I always remember of Bridget is the way she talked in her show Ant. It was called A Ant, which I loved. And this is sort of pre-explosion Bridget. She hasn't been in an explosion. This is before her profile blew up, Bridget. She did this brilliant routine, which I think we talked about when she was on this show, about how she did a routine where she was an ant and she was complaining that it was really difficult for ants in comedy because you kept getting asked questions about being an ant in comedy. And I was watching it and got it. Obviously, she's talking about women, but never says so. And it was a difficult bit of material on the night or the afternoon that I saw it. About 25% of us were killing ourselves laughing. And the others were sort of going, why is she talking about ants? I'm wondering whether I could pull off a reverse Bridget, a reverse Christie, and appear to be talking about feminism, but actually be talking about fatherhood. That'd be quite interesting, because the difficulty there is, good God, everyone's talking about feminism now. And I don't mean that to be negative. God, we're getting enough of this bloody feminism. I mean, purely from the point of view of a comic being on a bill of acts doing new material and seeing like 7 acts on the night refer either in passing or for the most part of their sets to feminism. I want to talk about it. I want to talk about the impact it has on my life and the fact that there's a small and tangible change that we as feminists can effect in the world. Like doing material about it, that definitely helps the cause. But at the same time, everyone's talking about it. It's become, I wouldn't dream of calling it hack, but it's become commonplace. It's like this year, you remember in 2009 when everyone did graphs? It's, feminism has been, you know, it's becoming a component of people's shows. So it would almost be quite fun to subvert that by being able to talk about the surface being about feminism, and then the actual thing that I was really talking about being fatherhood and the way in which you have a perspective of the world that is radically different when your eyes are opened to being a father, in the same way as that moment, which for me happened pathetically recently, of seeing the video of the woman walking down the street in New York getting catcalled. And that was a huge, I'm not saying I, you know, oppressed women before that deliberately, but that was a huge eye-opening moment for me whereby I realised, oh yeah, because I don't treat women like that, and no one I know, no one I hang out with treats women like that in front of me, so I don't see it happen. And then you recognise that not only does it happen from the perspective of any woman, it happens all the fucking time. I'm preaching to the converted here. You're all sensible, morally sound people with a decent idea of how the world works. But that it's like if someone told me, I have never run a marathon and I never intend to, but it's like if you apparently when you're a marathon runner, everyone claps the entire time because whenever they see you, they clap, right? So from the point of view of the runner, clap, 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 clap the whole time. From the point of view of the police, I've often thought they probably think everyone drives at 68 miles an hour because whenever we see a policeman, we speed up to or slow down to 68 miles an hour. I'm fine. So that video really made me go, oh my God, from the point of view of the other side of the fence, it's that constantly. And just because I don't ever see it doesn't mean it's not there and that it's not happening in this sort of awful, awful, repetitive way. So here's the case. Can I talk about that on a surface level? Making, you know, I don't want to make a point. That's not what my jokes are about. But that might be a really funny lens through which to then the reveal is that I'm actually, or they could catch on to the fact that what I'm talking about is fatherhood and my reaction now to, I've sort of said the same thing in several different ways. You can see where I'm going with this. But there we go. That might be an interesting view into
a little peek into how my mind works. You may have heard me say this before. I already, the other way my mind works is going, Stu, just do stupid jokes because that's what you're funniest with. Stop trying to have a clever narrative arc and a through line, and not just narrative, because we, you know, I try and ditch that every time. It never works. Ditching it never works. But not just narrative, specifically, stop trying for your every comedy show to be like the film Memento. I wish I'd never seen the film, because it just made me want to have every show that I write have a big moment at the end where everyone goes, oh, he meant that the whole time. Oh, now I get it. God, Stu's clever. Why am I obsessed with this idea that why does every comedy show I do have to be an incredibly clever heist? Why can't it just be a show? So anyway, that's where my process is at the moment. I mean, it's quite possible that the cocktail of no sleep and all these endorphins and this oxytocin, I always want to say oxyacetylene, and that really is a welding gas. All of these kind of love drugs you get when you have a baby, they could well be addling my brains. That's where I'm at now. He's so lovely. What did I start off saying? He's so great. Yes, that was a prelude. He's so lovely. I love him to bits. But Jesus Christ, overwhelming isn't the word. Just the pressure it puts on your mind. The fact that you go, oh, I haven't left the house all day. And then naturally, I don't know if your mind works like this, me being me, I immediately think, oh, right, I never get to leave the house again. Like, I take any tiny thing that happens to me, magnifies enormously and go, oh, this is the new reality. This is what I'm thinking. Oh, am I cold at the moment? Oh, I suppose I better get used to being cold for the rest of my life. Oh, there's a drip in the ceiling. Oh, well, that's it. The house just drips now, you know. I mean, it doesn't now because we paid £110 to an emergency plumber who for a job that I genuinely could have done myself. Oh, so frustrating. Is there always, this is like the third or fourth one of these I've done at the end of a show, is there always some element of me being angry in them? Because maybe this is a really good opportunity for me to vent. Maybe this is the most useful element of this is that I can just get cross with a plumber. God, he was so friendly. He shook my hand about five times. I think if anyone shakes your hand five times, it means they're ripping you off. Either it's like them trying to convince you they're a good guy, or it's them knowing in their heart that they're a bad person and they're kind of trying to socially make up for it in a way that they don't even realise. Five handshakes for £110. If it was £100, I could have worked out. Oh, 22. So £22 per handshake is what my point was. I think I'm losing my mind. He's so beautiful, though. Little Boudros. You're going to take my word for it. You're not going to see him anytime soon, I don't think. Unless we're going to try and, if you come to the Bristol show, you might get to meet him, because I think his mum is going to try and smuggle him in. I've just realised there's material in the show about babies being in a papoose wearing ear defenders. And I think to get him into the show, we're going to have to dress him like that. This is like, it's not like anything. What's the word for when something you do in a stand-up comedy routine becomes part of your life? Is there a word for that? Because I have recently been editing my 2014 show audio recording for the show Extra Life, and I'm going to release it soon. I'm going to release it simultaneously on Bandcamp with Break Glass, which is Break Glass in Case of Emergency, which is now almost finished. I've heard a rough cut of that yesterday. It's superb. So those things are going to go up simultaneously. Break Glass is going to be free. My show is going to be like £3 or whatever you want. And I was listening to the show, Extra Life, and spoiler alert, it's all about how desperate I am to have a baby. So this is 2013/14 Goldsmith talking about wanting to have a baby, and I was editing it with the actual baby in my arms as I was doing it. And there probably doesn't need to be a word for that, because it's probably not going to come up that often. That'll do for now. Thanks for listening. These might get a bit longer. I suppose the only problem for people that don't want to hear them is additional megabytage. But you know what? If the interviews are good, And they bloody are good. I listened back to that Mark Steele one the other day. But if I do say so myself, what an excellent interview that was. God, I really enjoyed that. I don't get the chance to listen back to many of these, you know, unless I'm specifically doing research. I'm forging on to the next thing. That Mark Steele, he's great, isn't he? Anyway, like I said, losing my marbles. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.